Second reading this morning comes from the book of Genesis, the 11th chapter. This is just after the flood, after waters have covered the earth and God makes a new covenant with Noah and puts the rainbow in the sky never to again destroy the earth. And then there's a whole chapter on the descendants of Noah, and the family gets larger and larger and larger, and we come to this downer of a story in chapter 11, the Tower of Babel, which is almost always paired with the Pentecost text, which frankly is the preacher's preference, but sometimes we need to hear texts that we'd rather not preach on. Hear now these words from God to the church this day. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as they migrated from the east, they came upon a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built. And the Lord said, "Look, they are one people, and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there so that they will not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, it was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Please pray with me. Oh God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight. Oh God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So what is God's problem with Babel? After all the mistakes that human beings have been through in the first 10 chapters of Genesis, here they seem to have finally gotten it all together. After trying to become like God, eating the fruit, Cain killing his brother Abel, violence and evil spreading across the earth, the flood, here they finally seem to have figured out how to live together in unity and peace. Isn't that what we strive for in our communities, in our city, in our congregation? It's what the Apostle Paul prays for in the church, unity. It's part of an ordination vow that pastors and deacons and elders all take to work for the unity of the church. It's behind the One Baltimore that we've been working so hard for in this last year. Human unity is more often one of God's goals, not one of God's problems. Pentecost, the Pentecost story is a case in point. The rushing wind blows through Jerusalem, and suddenly people from different cultures and different languages can communicate across their differences. Unity is the outcome of the story in that case. Unity is the outcome of God's choosing Abraham so that all the nations of the earth shall be blessed through him. Unity is the goal of Jesus living, dying, and rising among us. Unity is praised in the book of Acts when all the believers share everything in common together. Unity is the great hope in the book of Revelation, at the end of our holy book, one city, one people, one God. Clearly, God is not opposed to unity in every situation. Unity alone doesn't seem to be a problem. So what is God's problem with Babel? They are one people, God says, and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. It would have been so helpful if God had added another sentence or two for clarification purposes. Nothing that they propose to do, such as building a nuclear weapon, or burning too much fossil fuel, or creating an entire synthetic human genome capable of creating human beings without parents. Nothing will now be impossible for them. If God had said that, we would have known more about God's total view of the situation. It's not towers that kill people, it's people who build towers who kill people. Then we'd know. Or if God had said, nothing that they propose to do now will be impossible for them, including overthrowing my rule, then we would have known that God is like every other tyrant, petty, threatened, ego-driven. Or if God had said, this is only the beginning of what they will do, next they'll rid themselves of the weaker ones among them, then they'll divide and conquer each other. Then the concentration camps will follow. And then war and the crimes that go with it. Too many humans in one spot with that kind of power never ends well. Then we'd know that God's punishing move was driven by the hope for peace, coupled with a firm knowledge of human nature as we know it. But we get none of that, nothing explicit to tell us whether God scatters this unified people because they're arrogant, or because their technology is headed for sinister ends, or because God is just threatened. We do, however, get some interesting clues. Let us make a name for ourselves, the people of Babel say, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The whole point of making a name for yourself is to get recognition from someone else, maybe to allay our fear that we will be overlooked or forgotten. It's why we build big buildings with names of donors or corporations or historic figures on them. It's why corporations pay to put logos on stadiums and t-shirts and tennis shoes and pop-up ads. It's why nations raise flags on foreign lands that they conquer. Recognition. You make a name for yourself to curry friends or intimidate enemies or both. But if you are the only human beings on the planet, there is no one else to intimidate. There's no one else to intimidate except God. For the people of Babel, that's the only other audience that there is. Let us make a name for ourselves, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. It's the fear of being scattered, of not having a united front against God that unites the people, that gives rise to their new brick technology, that brings them all together. It's fear that drives their unity, not a hope to build a city of peace for all to enjoy, not a hope to make sure no one is left out of care and concern, fear of being alone, fear of God. Fear of being alone before God. All of which makes me wonder how many of our human projects are motivated by the same kinds of fears. Is rebuilding Baltimore driven by compassion for those left out, justice for victims of unequal treatment and opportunity? Or is it driven by the fear of an uprising that might affect my neighborhood, my family, my privilege? Is our total embrace of social media motivated by a true desire to connect more deeply with other human beings, or by our inability to be with ourselves, by a primal fear of being alone? Is patriotism or religious faith or political party affiliation driven by a positive embrace of important values that we cherish? Or do we just need to elevate ourselves above people we fear? People sometimes we hardly even know. When is unity a positive outcome, and when is it evidence of our persistent human fear? When is unity evidence of the Pentecostal movement of the Spirit, and when is it just that old human desire to drive everyone else to conform and be like us? At Pentecost, the Spirit descends and people are given the ability to communicate across difference. Some say that it is a reversal of the punishment at Babel. But unlike Babel, the people at Pentecost do not suddenly begin speaking one language. And the miracle isn't charismatic expression so much as it is the ability to hear each other, to really hear each other, not by becoming the same, not by adopting the same language, not by unity through conformity driven mostly by fear, but by the grace of listening, the grace of hearing. Isn't it miraculous that this is the gift, this gift of hearing, that births the church? The gift of hearing people that we are not supposed to be able to hear. The gift of knowing others the world says we are not supposed to be able to know. The gift of unity that comes without conformity, coercion, or control. Walter Brueggemann calls the church a new language community where human speech is possible. A new language community where human speech is possible. I count this church a gift in these days when so much of the world seems unable to hear each other. When too many of us seem to prefer one-liner put-downs to compassionate listening, even from our presidential candidates. When an entire state, my home state of North Carolina, seems consumed with fears about the differences of a few. Fears that, in my mind, could be dissipated easily with the right dose of listening, of hearing, of knowing, of understanding. I'm grateful for this new language community where the Spirit makes human speech possible across our real differences of race or our imagined ones, across our different experiences of God, across our different experiences of faith. The church is birthed with the gift of hearing, the gift of listening to God and to each other. Of course, Pentecost is similar to Babel in at least one respect. There is no way to be close to God without becoming vulnerable. There is no way to be close to each other without vulnerability. You can't hear others speaking in their own language without getting close enough to listen. You cannot connect in community without putting yourself out there. The tallest towers in the world cannot insulate you from the God who desires and gives birth to relationship. And purchasing our unity by erasing difference only erases the possibility of real relationship. Some of you have read Brené Brown's book, Daring Greatly, in which she defines vulnerability as uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. Uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. Love, she says, brings this gift of vulnerability to the surface. Waking up every day and loving someone who may or may not love us back, she writes, whose safety we can't ensure, who may stay in our lives or may leave with a moment's notice, who may be loyal to the day they die or betray us tomorrow. That's vulnerability, she writes. The good news is that God knows that kind of vulnerability. Our God, who wakes up every day and loves a people who too often don't love back. This God who, in the stories of our ancestors, endures chapter after chapter of a people who try to guard their own vulnerability with towers and weapons and knowledge. This God who knows just how deeply human beings are driven by fear. God knows this about us and stays in relationship. In these days of division in our country, the temptation is to look for unity by erasing our differences, closing the gaps between human beings by ending difference, bombing the opposition with our destructive words or actions, closing the gaps, maybe even between heaven and earth, by ending the distinction between human and divine. I think God knows that these projects rarely end well. There is another way. It is made possible by the Spirit, whose gift enables human beings to cross difference without obliterating it, to hear and be heard. It starts in our story among a small group of disciples who gather to remember the one who bridged the human-divine difference by walking into uncertainty and risk to show us a different way.